The CNBC app. Global market news in one place. Customizable sections and personalized alerts. Stocks tracking, interactive charts and market insights all in your hands. Stay connected. Stay informed. Download the CNBC app today.
Happy Monday, everybody. A happy bank holiday for you in the United Kingdom. These are your headlines on Squawkbox. Berkshire Hathaway's cash pile surges to a record $189 billion as the Oracle of Omaha uses the investment giant's AGM to shed more light on how they will function after his passing.
I think the responsibility ought to be entirely with Greg. We do not want to try and have 200 people around that are managing $1 billion each. It just doesn't work.
Wall Street ends higher on the week, on a high. The Dow adding 450 points as a weaker than expected jobs report boosts bets the Fed could start cutting rates soon.
Chinese President Xi Jinping touches down in Paris on the first leg of his European tour, with French leader Emmanuel Macron set to push for progress on trade disputes and support for Ukraine.
UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak admitting that there is work to do. That's as his ruling Conservative Party comes third in a bruising set of local elections.
Good morning, Karen. How goes it?
Good morning. Well, thank you. How are you?
Very, very tired after a busy weekend.
Should have taken a Monday. It's a holiday here today.
Yeah, apparently it's a bank holiday. And but cunningly, we can't get into the system that gives us the day back as well. That's definitely not a plan from the management.
So this one's for free for the company, right?
No, it's certainly not. I will remember it and stick it on a post-it on my desk and put calendar reminders in. I don't give them anything back. Lots to discuss. I mean, since we've been on air, we've had Omaha, Nebraska, and we've also had the payroll as well. Both huge events. They are dominating the top of this show. So let's go into the former of those two stories. Billionaire investor Warren Buffett has used the Berkshire Hathaway annual general meeting to discuss the future of the company, including his own succession plan, as well as the group's recent investment decisions. The cash pile at the Omaha-based conglomerate swelled to a record $189 billion in the first quarter. Now, Berkshire sold just under $20 billion in stock in the first 3 months of 2024, whilst purchasing $2.7 billion in new stock. The group also reduced its stake in Apple, one of its largest positions. Mr. Buffett also touted the current vice chair of non-insurance operations, Greg Abel, as his successor. The Oracle of Omaha told investors he trusts Abel to make future decisions, including those involving the company's prized stock portfolio.
I think the responsibility ought to be entirely with Greg. The responsibility has been with me, and I farmed out some of it. And I used to think differently about how that would be handled. But I think the responsibility should be that of the CEO. And whatever that CEO decides may be helpful in effectuating that responsibility, that's up to him or her to decide at the time they're running the money. But so I would say that my thinking on that has developed to some extent, as the sums have grown so large at Berkshire. And we do not want to try and have 200 people around that are managing $1 billion each. It just doesn't work.
Berkshire Hathaway has also made the most of higher interest rates. It earned $1.9 billion in interest income. $1.9 billion in interest income from its cash pile in the first quarter, alone, which is mostly invested in short-term treasuries. Buffett defended his decision not to use the cash pile to make new investments.
If we had $10 billion, I wouldn't basically see many more opportunities than we found. Now, it's true that something like Japan, we could have done. If the company had had a $30 or $40 billion, and we'd have had great returns on equity. But if I saw one of those now, I'd do it for Berkshire. you know, it isn't like I'm got a hunger strike or something like that going on. It's just that things aren't attractive.
Buffett also discussed Berkshire's holding in Apple after trimming their stake in the company.
We will own, unless something really extraordinary happens, we will own Apple and American Express and Coca-Cola. It doesn't bother me in the least to write that check. And I would really hope with all that America's done for all of you, it shouldn't bother you that we do it. And if I'm doing it at 21% this year and we're doing it at a higher percentage later on, I don't think you'll actually mind the fact that we sold a little Apple this year.
Operating profit at Berkshire Hathaway rose 39% in the first quarter to $11.2 billion. The company saw a 185% year-on-year increase in insurance underwriting earnings. Despite posting a record cash holdings in the quarter, Berkshire also posted a 64% decline in net earnings. These include fluctuations from its stock investments. Oh, number one point, the cash holdings. I think that is significant given that many market participants have been all in, given the escalation we've seen in the stock market. So is it one of those points where you think, well, am I overinvested at this stage in equities? Should I be pulling back? Should I be raising cash for some better entry point down the line? So I think number one takeaway point. The other point was around Apple, and we discussed this even before the weekend's events, whether they were holding on to too much Apple. It seems like they were, that it was better perhaps to raise some cash, balance the portfolio.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. They're the two key points as well. On the cash front as well, he's making the key point, and actually is a great lesson for all our viewers, for us as well. You don't have to go all in when interest rates are as high as they are. The quote here is, "I don't think anybody sitting at this table," so addressing the meeting, "has any idea how to use it effectively." This is the $189 billion cash pile. "And therefore, we don't use it now at 5.4%, but we wouldn't use it if it was at 1%. So that's very interesting. So just doubling down almost. I mean, yes, 5.4% and earning that much interest that we mentioned in the first quarter as well. But he's saying we still wouldn't necessarily know what to do if it was trading at 1%. So look, yeah, they are making vast amount of money from their Apple holdings and other holdings as well. And those underwriting fees you just mentioned as well. They don't need to deploy it in order to make vast amounts of money from that stake and from the rest of their portfolio. You talk about Apple as well. I think it's very interesting. We were talking about whether the ardor for this stock has gone down over at the company. The implication, and there's a terrific piece on the CNBC website, I think it's Steve Kovac, Yun Lin wrote it as well, but Steve Kovac is quoting it as well. It's basically saying, look, it's basically part of a tax bill as well. In the first quarter of release earnings as well, the bet is still worth $135.4 billion, implying somewhere in the region of 790 million shares. That is 13% decline from its highs as well. The filing, when accounting for the change in Apple stock, would imply Berkshire sold 116 million shares. Now, answering questions, he implied the sale is tied to him wanting to avoid a higher tax bill down the road if rates go higher to fund a ballooning U.S. fiscal deficit.
So I think we've learned a lot about entry and exit points. Entry point, of course, important what you're buying the stock at, but also having an exit plan. And this is something a lot of fund managers have been discussing with us, that you need to have an eye on when is the right time to step through that door and exit. And I think what we're seeing
on the stocks, or as an individual pulling back as from your career?
On individual stocks.
Okay.
You know, what is the timing of that exit? And I think at this point, there's a lot of investors sitting on fairly decent returns. And if you had Nvidia stock, for instance, if you had the S&P 500, I mean, they've been pretty good returns. So is now that point where you should be thinking, am I being greedy by holding on? Should I be lightening up on some exposures? Just to push on, though, I think.
But just to say that he's not getting rid of this stock. He, in fact, made the comment that it is extremely likely that Apple will remain the largest holding right to the end of 2024.
That's right, but how much is too much? And I think if you've been in the market, you've had some fairly decent returns, and some of those exposures have grown. So do you want to think about trimming them back to an extent, even if you still like the stock, is the point. The big element here was AI, how he felt about AI. I mean, this is one of the big drivers for the market. It's not just the re-rating around monetary policy, clearly a driver Friday, but before that, there's been this undercurrent around AI and what it's done for the market. You know, Buffett was talking about the potential for AI scamming being the next big growth industry. He was somewhat nervous about the technology, and was interesting to hear that pushback, because, you know, tech for good has kind of sort of faded off the table in a way. It's really been about AI growth. So to hear that it could be tech for bad as we talk about AI, I think that's really interesting.
Yes, I do. I agree. I think there's a lot more to that. But I think we'll move on because there's the other huge story. By the way, for the full rundown of Warren Buffett's comments at Berkshire, I was referring to that piece as well. Really good piece, actually, by Yun Lee as well on the CNBC.com website. You can find it there. Right. On a programming note, our US colleagues will be live from the Milken Institute's Global Conference in Los Angeles, talking to political leaders and C-suite executives. You can catch their interviews with the likes of Darren Woods from Exxon and Citi's Jane Fraser and David Solomon from Goldman's right here on CNBC. The payroll was very interesting, Karen.
Yeah, let's get into the weeds and the numbers. U.S. non-farm payrolls came in below Wall Street expectations in April. The economy added 175,000 jobs compared to a Dow Jones estimate of 240,000, while the unemployment rate, that ticked higher to 3.9%. Now, the data has raised the prospect that the Federal Reserve could cut interest rates sooner. Traders are increasingly betting on a 25 basis point cut in September, thanks to the weekend events, now according to the CME's group FedWatch data. Let's just take a look at some of the comments. Warren Buffett praised the Fed chair, Jerome Powell, for steering the U.S. economy through difficult times in the past years, but urged lawmakers to help prop up the central bank.
Jay Powell is a not only a great human being, but he's a very, very wise man. But he doesn't control fiscal policy, and every now and then he sends out a kind of a disguised plea for please pay attention to this, because that's where the trouble will be if we have it.
The market seeking some cooler data, and that was enough to see another tick higher for the major boards. The Nasdaq in particular, 2% up by the close of the session, 1.25% in the green, and 1.2 pop for the likes of the Dow. So very firm ranges we saw here. If you just drill down by sectors, we saw technology again leading the charge, 3% gain there in session. Energy was the laggard. So again, more appetite. Big Fang stocks also moving to the upside, and banks in the mix. So you saw some gains there. But to treasuries, let's take a look at the wash up for the market, 4.80, so peeling back off that 5% level for the 2 years, so pulling back as you can see, and below 4.5% at the 10-year, the long end of the yield curve. To the dollar and the implications for the trade, you can see morning session, there's appetite elsewhere. Euro on the front foot now versus the dollar. Sterling trying to hold on to those early gains. We're 125.40 plus for sterling dollar. Euro trades 107.62. On the back foot, though, for dollar versus for the Japanese yen, rather, versus the dollar, I should say, despite what was a lot of action last week as the yen was trying to claw back some territory and lots of talk of intervention by the BOJ. But this morning, a greenback has it, dollar fading versus the yuan. Let's get to Carl Weinberg, chief economist and managing director, High Frequency Economics. Carl, great to have you back on board with us. And let's get into these numbers on the payroll side. What we saw there, a slowdown in some areas, in particular construction, leisure, public service. Was this enough to give you some encouragement that the labor market is starting to cool a bit?
Not one bit, Karen. Thanks for having me back on the program. I wish you'd read all the numbers on the payrolls. I mean, you cited the slowdown to 175, but you didn't mention that in the previous report for March, we were at 315, and the average of the 2 months was 245,000 jobs. There's nothing wrong with that. And if you go back to the 2 months before that, you look at January and February, the numbers were 236 and 256. That average is 246, almost exactly the same number. And you go back to November and December, and the average of those 2 months was 290 and 182, averages to 236, almost the same number. In other words, with ups and downs along the way, the payroll numbers still continue to be showing increases in jobs that are quite strong. I think that it's premature to run off on the one number of 175 and say, oh my gosh, it is down from the huge number that preceded it. But the fact is that the labor market has been creating jobs at about 240,000, 250,000 jobs a month since last summer. And this last number just doesn't move the needle as far as I'm concerned. The trend remains intact.
Are you saying it's premature then for the market to wrestle back another interest rate cut and price and effectively two rate cuts now for this year?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, I think two rate cuts is the right number. You know, when we started the year and people were at 6 and 7 rate cuts for the year, you know, that left us at High Frequency Economics scratching our heads. The dot plot told us that the Fed itself expected to do two rate cuts this year, and that's pretty much what we're still expecting them to do. We see the economy slowing but not falling into recession. We think there's a case for cutting rates to prevent real interest rates from rising to new, even record high levels as inflation slows. But we do expect inflation to continue to slow as the economy moves further and further, but only by a little bit, but incrementally away from full employment. We expect the Fed to focus more on its second mandate to maintain full employment. So rate cuts to keep real rates from rising, fine. Recession, no. Is this big number that we saw on Friday a disappointment? Not one all. It's just noise along a constant path of job creation in a strong economy.
Yeah, Mr. Weinberg, I completely agree with you about the people going off to the races on one bit of data. They didn't even remember the fact that we had the ECI index, which is actually a couple of days earlier, showing a stunningly robust picture as well. Here's a point. Monday, Barkin and Williams. Tuesday, Kashkari, Jefferson, Collins, Cook. Friday, Bowman, Logan. They're all speaking this week. What on earth are they going to say that's actually meaningful? Because once again, Carl, we've got this play-by-play commentary from the Federal Reserve, voters and non-voters. I just can't think why the market would hang on to every word, but it will.
Well, they're not going to get a lot to hang on, most likely. It's unlikely that any of these Fed speakers are going to deviate from the script that Jay Powell laid out last week and before that at the IMF meeting and in other interviews in between. You know, the Fed is not yet convinced that the conditions are there to cut rates, but they feel that there are rate cuts in the future. And unless we get convincing evidence that inflation is clearly on its path back to 2%, which for the moment at least is not yet there, or we get signs of a recession, they're in no rush to cut rates, nor should they be, Steve. I mean, my goodness, the economy's running at full employment. It's disinflating at full employment. Wages are slowing. Everyone who wants a job has a job, and we're growing at close to potential, all right? It's not really broken. It doesn't really need to be fixed. They have no real immediate mandate to move, and they're taking advantage of that to be sure that they don't make a mistake. That's good policymaking.
Carl, the other thing which we've got a guest talking about a little bit later on as well, and I'm sure you concur, is that the actual neutral rate is going up all the time to the highest level in decades as well. Where do you see the neutral rate at the moment? I've seen a 4% figure mentioned for the first time this week.
Well, the neutral rate is supposed to be, our star is supposed to roughly be the potential growth rate of the economy. And right now, we're at full employment, so our growth is constrained. You know, the only way we can create new jobs is to increase productivity or to get more people working or through immigration. And none of those things are going to happen very quickly. Otherwise, we are going to exhaust the labor force. We're almost at full employment. So our star right now, I think, should be closer to the 2% figure, which is roughly the sum of what the population is growing at, added to what productivity gains can normally be expected to be.
Carl, I wanted to pick up on money supply. I was looking at some data suggesting that, you know, M2, it's fallen year over year, but for 16 months. We're right back to data we've not seen since 1960. Why is this not working when it comes to the economy? Why is the tightness of money not having an impact on inflation?
Oh, you know, I think money is what they should be looking at. I'm embarrassed to say that both our central bank and yours and all the central banks in the world are hardly looking at money supply at all, right? We increased the money supply in the United States by 35% in the early months of the pandemic. And what did we get? We got an increase in prices. There's no surprise in that. That's Econ 101. And now that the money supply has peaked and it's starting to come down because of QT, and the real money supply is being deflated by higher levels of prices, we're getting back to where we ought to be, and prices are leveling off at a new higher level. I mean, Econ 101 says it's going to work. You just have to be patient. It doesn't always work in the time frame that the market expects, but it is going to work.
Lovely to see you, Carl. Thanks for waking up so early or staying up late for us live from New Jersey. Am I supposed to say New Jersey or do you say New Jersey?
No. New York, Stone Ridge, New York.
It said New Jersey, didn't it? I think somebody's misstrapped you. Anyway, I just like saying New Jersey. Okay, thank you very much indeed for that. Carl Weinberg from Stone Ridge, New York, Chief Economist and Managing Director at High Frequency Economics. No, you don't fancy saying New Jersey?
No.
We had a producer once who came over from the States and worked with us over here, and she was a New Jersey. So anyway, Arabile, how do you pronounce New Jersey?
Definitely not like that, that's for sure. But nonetheless, here's what's coming up on the show. China is in focus as the Caixin PMI data points to slowing growth, as, of course, President Xi Jinping is embarking on his charm offensive on a tour of Europe, of course. Plus, the UK's ruling Conservative Party, well, they're licking their wounds after a bruising set of local elections. We'll unpack all of that. And we'll hear from Giuseppe Bivona, the partner as well as CIO at Bluebell Capital Partners, as the firm suggests BlackRock is a new form of investment risk. That's criticism that BlackRock has called misguided, incorrect, and contradictory. We'll unpack next.
Listen to CNBC's Beyond the Valley, the podcast that explores the biggest tech news from across the globe. Join me, Arjun Karpal.
And me, Tom Chitty, every week as we bring you insights into the top stories, unpack the latest trends, and find out where the industry is headed.
Now available on Spotify, Apple Music, and Google Podcasts.
Let's take a look at the Japanese yen, which is trading weaker in the morning session after touching a three-week high on Friday. The Japanese currency saw its biggest weekly gain in over 17 months, following suspected government interventions to pull the yen back away from its 34-year low. Japan's stock market is closed for a public holiday today. However, authorities did appear to use last week's quiet periods to intervene in the yen market. At the Asian Development Bank meeting, Dan asked the Japanese finance minister how they will stabilize the yen.
When there is an excessive movement, it may be necessary to smooth it out.
Speaking of the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting, Warren Buffett said he found Japanese trading houses compelling. The group acquired stakes in five of the houses, quote, as fast as they could, in an initial purchase worth roughly $6 billion in 2020. He did, however, add that it's unlikely that they'll make any large commitments in any other countries.
Our Japanese experience has been fascinating in that respect. So there may be an unexplored or unattended to opportunity in that area. I'm not the one to do it, but that may be something that in the future, it might be opportunities.
Didn't help too much. In the future, there might be opportunities. Anyway, moving on. Paramount has reportedly decided to open formal negotiations with a group led by Sony Pictures and private equity giant Apollo, according to the New York Times. A Paramount committee tasked with evaluating offers reportedly met yesterday after exclusive talks with Skydance expired on Friday. Warren Buffett addressed Berkshire Hathaway's sale of its entire Paramount stake at a loss.
I was 100% responsible for the Paramount decision. I read speculation that one of them, either Ted or Todd, had some involvement in that. No, it was 100% my decision. And we sold it all, and we lost quite a bit of money, and that happens in this business too.
Can happen even to the great and the good. Swedish private equity firm EQT has agreed to acquire, what do you reckon, Karen, digital consultancy Perficient?
Perficient.
I love the way the producer just chucked in, assuming we'd know how to pronounce it. Perficient? As in maleficent?
Yeah, exactly.
No, it's got to be Perficient, isn't it? I don't know, anyway. We've tried everything, anyway. Perficient, or what was the one you said?
Perficient.
You just said that one, didn't you? In an all-cash deal valued at around $3 billion, including debt, the deal, which is expected to close by the year-end, will see shareholders receive $76 for each
Perficient
share, nearly a 58% premium to Friday's closing price. We don't make this stuff up.
You know, I'm looking up the meaning of Perficient now.
Here you go. It doesn't mean anything, does it?
Someone who or something that accomplishes or completes a task.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, I couldn't complete that task, so no, not me.
It took two of us.
It did indeed. What if you share it? Duo Perficient.
Thank you for listening to Squawk Box Europe Express.
For more market-moving news, you can head to CNBC.com or join us again on the show with me, Steve Sedgwick, and Karen Cho, weekdays on CNBC.